Hey folks, welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte. I'm a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, you can check out my website at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
I have this cute video my husband took of me and our son playing in the park when he was about five. He's busy jumping and climbing and sliding down the slide, and then all of a sudden he smacks his head. You can see him come running around the slide to look for me. He runs into my arms, and I rub his ear and give him a hug and a kiss. Then he smiles and takes off again to go play. So why am I telling you this? Because it's an example of what my guest today would call proximity-seeking behavior. Something we do when we're under stress or need physical or emotional comfort. He's going to talk to us a lot more about this today as we talk to Dr. Gary Sipsey, attachment expert and co-author of the book Attachments, Why We Love, Feel, and Act the Way We Do. Dr. Sipsey is a clinical psychologist and marriage and family therapist at the Piedmont Psychiatric Center in Lynchburg, Virginia, where he works with children and families suffering from attachment-related problems and complex oppositional defiant disorder. He's done and continues to do extensive research on attachment. He's the director of Liberty University's PhD program in professional counseling. He's an author, a speaker, and is currently involved in a number of research programs, the most significant being the role of adult attachment, representations, and chronic depression. Dr. Sipsey, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you, Rita.
Wow, all that makes me want to go back and get my PhD.
We would love to have you.
Well, I'm passionate about this subject, and I believe it's so relevant to our work as counselors, and I love to teach my clients some of the basic tenets of this theory. So start us out today. Can you explain to our listeners what is attachment relationship and how is it different from other relationships?
Okay, well, you know, we usually start out with the idea that, you know, we're hardwired for relationships. So coming out of the womb, the fact that we want to be in close relationship and that we use relationships to help us grow, that God set it up this way, is a fundamental tenet. But the best way of understanding an attachment relationship is through what we call secure-based scenarios, very similar to what you described with your son. You know, that's a classic example. The best way to understand it, this is with the secure-based scenario, is to realize first and foremost that you know, kids rely on their parents for a sense of basic security. So you're not born with the capacity to feel secure. You're not born with the capacity to calm yourself down. So that occurs in the context of close relationships. So the parent provides a child what we call secure base. Right, so and you use yourself to help your child feel regulated.
When my son hits his head on the slide, he comes looking for me because he knows I'm his secure base.
Exactly. And and the fact that when you go to the park that he feels secure enough to leave your side to go explore the slide and to, you know, go try new things and to be curious, it presupposes that he believes you're already safe, that he's secure, and that he can go do these things. So when kids feel secure, then this active cultivates what we call exploration or autonomy. So kids can kind of explore the world, and this is the precursor to what we call self-esteem. So self-esteem begins with trusting others. When you trust them, then you can, launch yourself out there and go explore and be curious and fascinated. When something stresses you, so you can have stressors like in his case, he whacked his noggin, or in other cases, they may feel that a stranger may come into their space, or they may feel sick. Or tired, or something like that. At that point in time, then curiosity and exploration turn off, okay? And then proximity seeking, attachment behavior and proximity seeking kick in. And this is where a child is going to signal to the parent in whatever way that there's really a problem and start moving toward the parent, trying to get actual physical proximity to the parent. And then as they do this, then the parent becomes a safe haven. That's where the parent helps the child get calmed down.
A hug and a kiss. Yeah.
Now, in other situations where kids can have upsetting events, and it's very important to realize it. So in this case, he whacks his noggin, and you provide a safe haven for him. He gets secure, and he feels his batteries are charged, and he goes back out and takes on the world. But now it's interesting and important for people to realize that that's not the only type of secure-based scenario. Secure-based scenarios unfold around emotionally charged events. And, from anger to frustration to anxiety to sadness, when emotions are expressed, if you will, how the parent helps the child deal with their emotions and to deal with their upsets is crucial, because what's happening is that the brain records these scenarios and then draws conclusions about oneself, about the world, about others, these basic assumptions that are actually pre-verbal. They're not directly accessible to your awareness, but they do become the lens through which you look at the world, and we call these working models. Mm. They get formed, and they get stored in the brain at some of the deepest levels in the emotional brain, and they become then the glasses through which we look at future relationships. So how parents respond to these different emotions plays a crucial role in establishing what we call the attachment styles.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's the core of understanding how attachment works. And by the way, we can measure these representations, these core beliefs, internal working models, by 1 year of age. And they're incredibly stable over time, and they extend all the way into adulthood.
Mm. There's been a lot of talk in the counseling world and in this world of brain-based neurobiology about attachment. And it started, back in the mid-20th century with British psychiatrist John Bowlby, who was really the father of attachment theory. And mm-hmm. His ideas were simple but powerful. It's what you alluded to a few minutes ago. He believed the nature of a child's attachment to their primary caregiver would become internalized, as a working model of attachment. So elaborate on that a little bit. Internalized working model, set us up for these styles of attachment.
Well, so, as we said, before the language was that these relationship scenarios would become internalized, and that was sort of a, fuzzy process. How does that become internalized? Now, with our understanding of the way that memory is formed, implicit memory, which are these underlying scripted belief systems that tell you what to do, what to look for, how to behave, and in situations, how they get formed in the brain. So, for example, when you drive a car, you don't really have to think about what you're doing. You do it automatically because you've done it so many times. And you don't even have to think about driving a car to get in and drive it. You don't have to remember when you first learned how to drive a car to get in and drive it. And if you stop driving for 10 years, you could get back into the seat and start driving almost as if you had never stopped. So that's, in a similar way, working models become encoded in the brain. And then they, in attachment situations, they get turned on and they're activated and they guide what you do. But the, but there's different styles of attachment. And that's one of the things that Bowlby was able to identify, and then later more clearly by Mary Ainsworth and then Mary Main. But anyway, what happens is a lot of how these attachment styles get formed is, let's take these emotions that we were talking about. Insecure kids, usually what happens is that their parents encourage the child to explore the world after they get safe. So they don't over-encourage them, they don't under-encourage them, but they do provide safety, and then the child naturally explores the world. And when they get upset, even in the smallest ways, they may come home and throw their book bag on the floor, and they may look kind of sad or like they're kind of having a bad day, and the parent addresses these emotions directly. Hey, buddy, you look like you look like you're not feeling too good. What's up? So that would be an example of a parent being a secure base and being open to the child's emotions. When children come to the parent with emotion or have a negative emotion or negative feelings, the parents respond in ways where they accept the child's emotion but also set limits on their behavior, and they also help them problem solve and figure out, what do you do? How do you fix this? Or, you know, what's a way of looking at this? So they coach their child into learning how to deal with frustration, and that's how they become secure base. What happens is children develop a basic model that says, look, I'm pretty confident that if I go out here in the world and I get in trouble, I can always count on my caregiver to help me out. They'll help me figure it out. And as a result, they're okay with their emotions, they're okay with other people's emotions, and they're basically okay with intimacy. Now, in other situations, there's parents who actually they push their child too quickly into autonomy and exploration. They really want their child to be, as quickly as possible, self-sufficient. And when their children get upset and have displays of negative emotion, they consistently are rejecting and sometimes belittling. So if your son, you know, when he was upset and whacked his noggin and came back and you said, oh, quit whining, you'll be okay, that's no big deal, go on back out there. That would be small. Nobody would think, oh my gosh, that's a horrible parent. But it does send this message that says, you know, negative emotions really are not to be displayed.
Yeah, because it's the consistency of the interaction then. It's
right.
One isolated incident, but if we have, you know, a parent who consistently responds this way,
exactly,
then this is helping the child form belief systems about themselves, their abilities, about you, and about the world around us.
Exactly. So one incident like this does not create, you know, what we call an avoidant or dismissing attachment style. These are repeated episodes where a parent pushes a child away, ignores their emotion, minimizes it, or deals with it harshly.
So what would a child who has this kind of daily interaction for several years, uh-huh, what belief system would this child be forming about himself and about others?
Great question. So what this tends to form what we call an avoidant attachment. And what happens with these types of children is that they think, listen, I have to count on me and me alone. I cannot count on other people to be there for me. So, you know, basically,
trust issues right out of the chute.
Right out of the chute. But the way they deal with their trust issues is that they minimize their need for intimacy and for closeness and for attachment. Now, the result of this is that they tend to become very self-absorbed. They can be friendly people, they can be fun-loving, but when you get close to them, you'll realize that they're very self-absorbed. They don't like expressing their feelings. They have difficulty with intimacy and getting close with others.
Now, they kind of hold others on the periphery of their life. They don't really let them in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of more severe expressions of this, they're much more prone to addictions, and they're also prone to various forms of perfectionism. In other words, they are all about achievement. They're all about, a lot of times, they're very much into things over people. And you know, if they get depressed, it's usually because something goes wrong in their life. You know, they didn't get the job they wanted, they didn't get the raise they wanted, they didn't get the grade they wanted. So they're very performance oriented perfectionists, and they also tend to be emotional perfectionists. So they get upset with themselves when they have negative emotions. They don't think they should ever feel anxious or ever feel sad or ever feel lonely. And they really come down hard on themselves. So that is the avoidance style of attachment. That's where they shut down their need for attachment.
Okay. If you've just joined us today, we're talking with attachment expert Dr. Gary Sipsey. Gary, how about the anxious PERT child? How does the parent help to create that kind of a belief system of anxiety, fear, what have you?
Well, on that side of the equation, usually it's almost the opposite. Instead, in this case, the parent themselves tends to be somewhat anxious and emotionally
protective. Maybe
they can be overprotective, and they sort of discourage the child from seeking autonomy and independence because they think the world's threatening. That could be one reason. Other parents want to keep the child close by because they feel like the child should be their buddy or their pal or their own. They use the child as their own emotional support system. The other
problem. These folks may be apt to develop anxiety disorders. I have a lot of folks like this.
Absolutely.
Parents have been suffocating, you know, fearful themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're more prone to anxiety disorders and other emotional dysregulation disorders, if you will. I mean, depression, anxiety. They tend to be fairly fearful. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that the child sometimes suppresses their own emotional needs just because they're into taking care of the parent, and they're constantly vigilant and worried about what's, you know, is mom okay? Is she all right? A lot of these kids will develop separation anxiety disorder, where it's not so much that they're afraid to go to school because they think something will happen to them, is that they're afraid to go to school because they're afraid something will happen to their mom. Bowlby, interestingly, wrote a lot about this back in his day, and he would claim that, you know, most separation anxiety was a result of a kid wanting to stay home to be close to the parent to make sure they were okay, than to just that the child was afraid something was going to happen to them. I recently had a kid who, you know, had the school phobia, and we were working with him, you know, I suspected that this was going on. We were talking, about how kids sometimes worry that their own anger and their own frustration can actually hurt the parent. Parents would give them that impression. And I had talked to the parents about this. And interestingly, about 3-4 months before this, the father had had a heart condition and had a heart attack and was in the hospital. And he came out, and he was doing fine. But the child was really having some anger problems, which is common for kids in that kind of situation. And the mom remembers saying to the kid, "You better watch out, because if you keep acting this way, you're going to kill your dad."
So how do you help folks through this? I mean, people come to you for counseling with their kids. You know, there's not a safe haven relationship. What do you do to correct some of these problems? Can you just give us a few?
Well, I mean, it depends. So with the avoidant parents, we really try to work with helping them become emotion coaches, where they learn to pay attention to the smaller signs of distress and anxiety from their child and to move toward their child instead of either away from them or against them when they're upset. So, you know, being able to say, "Hey, you know, how'd your day go?" And if the child complains that this happened or that happened or this happened, instead of trying to fix it, just try to listen to them. And try to, you know, we try to work with parents with avoidant kids on empathy, because usually they're very rejecting and somewhat cold, and they dislike emotional displays. So this is teaching them how to use empathy, and then from empathy we move into teaching them how to do problem solving. Another thing that we do is we work on with with these parents on doing what we call banking time. This is having one-to-one interactions with your kids that aren't designed around, you know, doing homework or eating dinner or, you know, bathing or, you know, all the routine of the day, but instead of having just one-to-one time with them and that child that doesn't include any of the other children. Now, sometimes even when you try to get parents to do this, you'll find that they can't do it for a lot of different reasons, and this itself is diagnostic. Sometimes it's because the family's too chaotic and they can't do it, but other times it's because the parents themselves have a lot of attachment avoidance, and then they have a hard time getting actually close to their kid without feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, so it's their own stuff.
Absolutely. In fact, most of it's their own stuff when they can't get close to their child. And a lot of times they don't have their own memories to draw from of having any close interactive exchanges with their parents. So they've learned how to, you know, disregard them and push them aside, and they do the same thing with their child.
Do you suggest counseling for some of these folks?
I mean, oh, yeah. In fact,
individual work?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, especially, you know, when usually these kids are coming in because they have, you know, behavioral problems. You know, so not everybody out there who might notice some of these patterns in their relationships or with their kids necessarily need to do counseling. But usually if it's bad enough, it'll manifest itself as some type of family problem, you know, and then you would want to get it addressed.
So
now, on the flip side, I just want to mention with the anxious mother, sometimes, you know, our goal is helping her figure out what's going on with her own self. Either she's got depression or she's got an anxiety disorder, and we need to treat that as well as helping them with their child. So, you know, sometimes it really does have, these parents have undiagnosed, untreated depression or anxiety. We got to make sure we take care of that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so Susie grows up and she's got an avoidant attachment. How do you see this impacting her relationship with God? Because God is our ultimate attachment figure. We know that sometimes people impose all the conditions of worth that have been imposed upon them. They transfer onto their relationship with God.
Right.
Talk about that for a minute.
Well, What happens is we start talking about one's relationship with God in terms of with people who are avoiding attachment. What you find is that they tend to get into religious activity, all right? But what they have tremendous difficulty doing is being close to God when things are going badly. Does that make sense? So we talk about the difference between internal versus external religious orientation. Somebody with external religious orientation is one who tends to go to church because that's what they did. They grew up that way. You know, you go, you read your Bible, you do the worship, you do this, that, and the other, and it's
but
very
they don't
outward.
Do intimacy well.
But the intimacy factor, in other words, when things start to go wrong in their life, they tend to turn away from God. That's when they stop praying. That's when they stop wanting to seek fellowship. That's when they don't believe that God can really be there for them. And sometimes they feel like God has turned against them. It's hard for them to imagine, you know, a God who could allow bad things to happen, but who also wants you to seek comfort in him. Seeking comfort in God is a very hard thing for people with avoidant attachment. They're very good at being religious and talking about God, and even, you know, sounding like a great, you know, some of our pastors out there, and great Bible teachers and you know, Christian leaders actually have avoidant attachment. So this, it's more of what you would see and experience inwardly than what you see outwardly. And many people with avoidant attachment are highly idealizing of their relationship with God, but when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, it's hard for them to rely on him.
Mm. How about the anxious folks?
The folks with anxious, you know, one of the things that we've done a fair amount of study on is on a religious doubt. They tend to struggle with a form of religious doubt that we call emotional doubt, where they often question, am I really saved? Does God really love me? Did I commit the unpardonable sin? How do I know that when I die that God won't say to me, depart from me, for I never knew you? Just as these folks do in close relationships when they grow up, they become quite clingy but also suspicious.
Constant reassurance they need.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the same kind of thing that you see in their relationship with God tends to play itself out.
Wow. Gary, I could talk to you for 2 days on this. I love this subject, like I said. How can folks contact you if they want to know more about this, if they want to know more about Piedmont Center? What's a good way to get a hold of you?
Well, if you, if there's clinical concerns or somebody wants a consultation, the Piedmont Psychiatric Center is 434-200-5999. My email is gary.sibsey@centralhealth.com. As far as at Liberty, our PhD program, I teach a class there specifically on attachment theory, and all our approaches are developmentally oriented in our program in terms of our clinical stuff. But you can get me at gsibsey@liberty.edu.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I know how busy you are. I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk to us today about it.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay, God bless.
Likewise.
That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.